The Rav, Rav Soloveitchik, a blessed memory, is famous for having said that it's necessary to study the Sidur like a Gemara, like a page of Talmud. The truth is, although prayer is accessible on a surface level, you can open the book and say the words, yes, but the truth is, it is extremely subtle. And we ought to expend energy to try to appreciate the subtleties of prayer. And what I want to share with you tonight is two examples. One is an emotional subtlety, to be attuned to the emotions that prayer calls from us. And then the second is a textual subtlety, to show you the care with which each word is placed. And both of these things are examples of aspects of prayer that are very, very easy to miss. But if we are attuned to them, it will add a great depth to our prayer experience. And these examples should alert us to the level of critical thinking and reading that is necessary in order to get what prayer deserves. So if you turn, please, to page 529. Page 529 is a tefillah, a prayer that we say on Shabbos morning. And it's the prayer Avarachamin. So if you look on the English side, 528, Avarachamin, Father of Compassion, remember the holy communities that sacrificed their lives for the sanctification of God's name. So this prayer was written after the Crusades that took place in Western Europe in the 12th century and the 13th century, mostly in France and Germany. And as you may know, there were entire communities that were decimated. And those who were killed al kiddush Hashem, sanctifying God's name, simply because of the fact that they were Jews. Now, the truth is, this phenomenon is true in other periods of Jewish history, both before the Crusades and after the Crusades, Holocaust being a prime example. But the rampages of the Crusades had a particularly deep impact. First of all, tremendous terror and suffering and persecution and death. But also, the Crusades resulted in some very major shifts in the Jewish world and in Jewish history. Just to mention one example, at about the year 1000, the main Ashkenazi population center was the area of Western Europe, France, and Germany. By 1400, the population had shifted eastward to East Europe, mostly Poland. And that shift occurred for a number of reasons, but one of them was the Crusades. This past summer, I spoke and I discussed two other deep impacts that the Crusades had on the course of Jewish history and Jewish life. I'm not going to repeat it now, but just to say it was a major, major period.
We focused on it in Tisha B'Av.
Right, I spoke of that just before Tisha B'Av. And, you know, without the Crusades, can you imagine? Beef bourguignon, trout amandine instead of chalent and herring. You know? It's a big shift. So he ended up in Eastern Europe. Okay. The first thing to say about this prayer is it's a little bit strange to say it on Shabbos at all. Because it's not really the most uplifting. It's really kind of a sad thing. Hashem, have compassion and remember the people that died as martyrs. And you should take revenge on them. And their memory should never be forgotten. It's actually pretty sad. It's pretty close to mourning. And as a general matter, we don't allow public mourning on Shabbos. So the truth is, a strong case could be made not even to say it at all. But we do. We do. I guess it just barely makes it into what is acceptable to say on Shabbos. We're gathered as a community. It's Shabbos. And we think about something a little bit heavy. It's a little bit out of character. But, okay. However, whenever there is a special occurrence that occurs on Shabbos, let's say Shabbos falls on Yom Tov, then we omit it. Because, yes, Shabbos is very, very holy, the holiest. Yom Tov, there's a special mitzvah to rejoice. So on Yom Tov, it's even further not appropriate to say this prayer. So Shabbos by itself, it's a little hard to make the calculus. Shabbos by itself, okay, we're going to say it. But whenever something moves the needle even a little bit, if it's Shabbos and Yom Tov, we don't say it. Shabbos and Rosh Chodesh, we don't say it. Because Rosh Chodesh, the beginning of the Jewish month, is the way that we organize the holidays. So, we would not have Yom Tov without Rosh Chodesh. So, Rosh Chodesh also kind of, it's like announcing when the next holiday is going to be. So, that pushes the needle enough that we omit Avarachamim on Shabbos that falls on Yom Tov and Shabbos that falls on Rosh Chodesh. And this Shabbos. Yes?
If there's a baby naming or an offer of...
So, those are, again, other things that move the needle in terms of rejoicing, that so you see it's right on the edge. So all it takes is the smallest thing to add to what is already Shabbos, and we don't say Avarach, including this Shabbos. Why? So this Shabbos is Shabbos Mevarchen. Rosh Chodesh is next week on Tuesday and Wednesday. Rosh Chodesh Adar, the beginning of the Jewish month of Adar, the first Adar. This year, there are two Adars. So this Shabbos is Shabbos Mevarchim, and we omit Avarachimim. Now, if you just think about that, it's a little hard to understand. Because for example, what is special about Shabbos Mevarchim? I mean, this Shabbos, we are going to announce that this coming Tuesday and Wednesday is Rosh Chodesh. How is there a level of joy in the announcement? It's one thing to say if it's the holiday itself, it's the holiday itself. But now it's the announcement. The announcement, that pushes it over the line, and we omit Avarachim. However, between Pesach and Shavuos, when there is a Shabbos Mevarchim, we do say Avarachim. And the reason for that is because in the history of the Crusades, most of the violence of the Crusades occurred in that period of the calendar. So therefore, the Avarachamim is particularly appropriate in those weeks. So therefore, even if it would have been enough to omit it, but between Pesach and Shavuos, we still say it. But if it's actually Rosh Chodesh that falls on Shabbos, then we do not say it, even between Pesach and Shavuos. All right, sounds a little confusing, right? Here's the point that I want to get to. Pay attention to how subtle the Siddur asks us to be, how sensitive to what our emotions ought to be at any given moment. And as on a regular Shabbos, we should be feeling joyful, but not quite joyful enough that makes Avarachamim inappropriate. We say Avarachamim. But the least little thing, so what happens on Shabbos Mevarchim? Well, the only thing that happens is we say a prayer. We say a prayer, Yehi Ratzon Hashem, may it be your will in the coming month, that it should be a good month, that we should be a happy month, it should be a healthy month. And we have this prayer that we say, and we're thinking about praying for the happiness and the joy and the goodness that we want in the coming month. On Shabbos Mevarchim, a person should feel just a little bit happier than on a regular Shabbos, which is what makes Avarachamim inappropriate on that Shabbos. However, if it happens during the weeks when the actual violence took place, we should be thinking during those weeks about what happened in Jewish history. And that should take us back down a little bit under the line. And we do say it. It's so subtle, and the rules are so specific, and I'm asking you to pay attention to how they are at, the rules are asking us to modulate our emotions based on all of these factors. So when a person comes to shul on Shabbos, how we feel is not just a function of what's going on in our own lives, it's also a function of what's going on in the community, but the Siddur is giving us input into how we are supposed to feel emotionally on that day. And if we come to shul and there's some reason to omit Avarachamim, we should feel a little bit of a lift. Something. And vice versa. Yes. No, it's the same. I mean, it's the same for every Shabbos Mevarchim, right? We omit Avarachamim for every Shabbos Mevarchim. So while yes, it is true that there is a statement when the month of Adar approaches, we increase our joy. By the way, probably that refers to the second Adar. I don't want to bring anybody down, but in terms of this application, that applies every single month. So Shvat, we also didn't say it, Shabbos Mevarchim. And Shvat, I mean, what are you going to say? You know, Teves. Yeah. Okay. That's one example to try to be attuned to the emotional subtlety that the Siddur is trying to give us. I want to share with you a second piece. So if you turn, please, to page 751. So this Shabbos is Shabbos Mevarchim. We announce the coming of the Jewish month. Next week, Tuesday and Wednesday, is Rosh Chodesh Adar Rishon, the beginning of the Jewish month of the first Adar. This year is a Jewish leap year, so there is a first Adar and a second Adar. We add an extra month to the calendar, a Jewish leap year, approximately every 3 years, because the Jewish calendar is based on the lunar calendar. And the lunar calendar is 11 days shorter than the solar calendar. So that means if you would follow only the lunar calendar, every year, whatever date you want, let's say the first day of Pesach, the 15th of Nisan, it would turn up 11 days earlier in the solar calendar. With time, it would go all the way around. The Muslim calendar is purely a lunar calendar, and in fact, their holidays go all the way around. So Ramadan is now, I think, what is it, like early summer, I think, when it starts? So every year it's about 11 days earlier, and it goes all the way around the cycle. You could have Ramadan at every different season over the course of 30, 40 years. However, the Torah says that we exited Egypt b'chodesh ha'aviv, in the springtime. And from that we understand that we're required to adjust the lunar calendar so that Pesach always stays in the springtime. So if every year it would come forward 11 days, approximately every 3 years, we push it back a month to put it back in its place. And that's why Jewish holidays swing about a month back or forth, a total of a month back or forth, because of where we are in this cycle. The truth is, it's quite a complicated thing to be able to decide if a lunar year should be proclaimed. Now, for us, we rely on a Jewish calendar that's already been established many years in advance. So we know in advance which years will be a Jewish lunar year. However, in previous times, and presumably in the future, the rabbis at that time would make a determination based on how early it looked like Pesach was going to come. In other words, if it was still in the middle of the rainy season, and nothing had started to grow, and the roads were still muddy, that was a sign, it's too early, we have to push back Pesach, we add an extra month of Adar. But it worked out approximately to every 2 or 3 years, approximately. When it is a Jewish leap year, such as this year, starting from the month of Cheshvan, which is the second month right after Rosh Hashanah, through Adar Sheni, which is not this coming month, but the next month. So on Rosh Chodesh, the beginning of the month, we say a special prayer. The Musaf prayer, the Amidah, the standing prayer for Rosh Chodesh. And in a leap year, during those 6 months, on those 6 months, we add two words. So if you look in the Siddur, page 751, like the middle of page, this is the Amidah that we say for Rosh Chodesh. So we only say this on the days of Rosh Chodesh. Elokeinu, Elokei Avoseinu, our God, God of our ancestors, Chadesh Aleinu Es HaChodesh Hazeh, renew this new month for us. We're at the beginning of the month. Hashem, renew this month for us for good and blessing and joy, and gladness and deliverance and consolation and sustenance, support, life and peace, pardon of sin, forgiveness of iniquity. But those are all the things we want this month. But if it is a leap year between these 6 months, between Rosh Hashanah and Pesach, we add two words. We're not only asking God to pardon our sin, not only asking God to forgive our iniquity, but also asking God atonement of transgression. Sounds the same. And what's the big deal? And why add two words just because it's a leap year? So first of all, I'm sorry?
More time to sin.
So first of all, the difference doesn't show up so well in the English. If you look in the Hebrew, lemechilas chet, the slichas avon lechaparas pasha, chet is a sin that was done by accident or negligence. Avon is a sin that was done willfully but because of temptation. And pesha is a sin that was done as a rebellion against God. It's the most serious form of a sin. So we're asking God, normally we ask God, forgive us for the mistakes that we made and forgive us for giving in to temptation. But during these 6 months we add, and even forgive us, God, for the times that we tried to rebel against you. So, it's a pretty subtle thing. I would imagine that if it was not pointed out, a lot of people might not even notice it. And even if you do notice it, it is two words that are recited a total of 9 times every 3 years. So what kind of a lesson are we trying to teach with adding two words 9 times every 3 years? It's a very, very strange thing. So there are a lot of different opinions to answer this question. I'll give you an answer that I think makes sense, and that is, I alluded to it before, during the time that the new month and the year was established by the Sanhedrin HaGadol, the great Sanhedrin in Jerusalem, based on eyewitnesses, the decision of whether to make a year a leap year or not was a very weighty decision. And if they made a mistake, the Jewish people would be in big trouble. Because what that would mean is, on the day that was really Pesach, everybody's eating bagels and croissant and crackers, and because it's really supposed to be, it's going to be a month off. So, and the time period that was available to make this decision was between Cheshvan and the beginning of Nisan, between the month after Rosh Hashanah and before Pesach. That's when the decision had to be made. So therefore, it became the practice that our leaders have to make this gigantic, overwhelming decision during these months, we have an extra prayer to pray for the forgiveness of sins in order that Hashem should make sure that our leaders make the right decision about this very important decision. Okay. You like the answer. You don't like the answer. It's fine. It's one answer. There are other answers.
So today, we know already much more in advance.
Right. So we retain the practice from earlier, from the time that it was established by the Sanhedrin HaGadol, the great Sanhedrin. We retain that practice, and we include these extra two words. I want to share, I'll give you another answer, another kind of a simple answer. It's kind of like what you said. Rosh Chodesh has an element of Yom Kippur to it. Because, it's the opposite of what you said. We don't want people to just say all year long, listen, you know, I'll do whatever I want to do. When Yom Kippur comes, it's a day of atonement, I'll ask God for forgiveness for all my sins. So this year I have an extra month. That's not what Hashem wants. Rather, Hashem wants that every Rosh Chodesh, we should have an accounting to ourselves of what we've been doing during the past month, so that by the time we get to Yom Kippur, we do not have a whole year's worth of sins. It should not pile up. And in fact, if you look at the other prayers, I'm not quoting it all, but if you look at the other prayers of Rosh Chodesh, there are aspects of a day of forgiveness, a day of atonement. In fact, there are many people, some people, who observe the day before Rosh Chodesh every month as called Yom Kippur Katan, miniature Yom Kippur, exactly for this reason.
And they fast.
Yeah. Some people, they fast, they say special prayers. There's an order of prayers to say for Yom Kippur Katan. So therefore, maybe it goes like this, that on a year when there are 13 months, and that means that the real Yom Kippur is 1 month further, there are more sins to pray for. And therefore, we add this line. Of course, that doesn't explain why we stop after Nisan, because we still have the next half of the year. Okay. I want to share a different answer. And this answer is a profound approach. I heard this answer from Rabbi Yitzchak Huttner, of blessed memory. It's partially quoted in a sefer called Margalias Hayom, which is a commentary to the Talmud. And it involves a fascinating period in Jewish history. And it leads to a very important lesson and something that is very practical to all of us. One of the most tragic moments in all of Jewish history, one of the missed opportunities in Jewish history, occurred during the life of King Chizkiyahu. King Chizkiyahu lived approximately the year 560 before the Common Era, or in other words, he reigned about 140 years before the destruction of the First Temple. So this is like the middle of the First Temple period, approximately halfway between David HaMelech, King David, and the destruction of the First Temple, approximately halfway. Now, about 200 years before this story, after King David, and after Shlomo HaMelech, King Solomon, Shlomo died. Right after Shlomo HaMelech, King Solomon died, there was a civil war in Israel. A very terrible, tragic thing. And Israel was split into two kingdoms. There was the kingdom of the south, known as the kingdom of Yehuda, because the tribe of Yehuda was the largest tribe in that area. And the northern kingdom was known as the kingdom of Israel, Malchus Yisrael. In general, the kingdom of Yehuda, the southern kingdom, was more religious, more loyal to the Torah. It had, after all, the Beis HaMikdash and the Kohanim and the Karbanos, the sacrifices. And in general, the northern kingdom, which was comprised of 10 tribes, was, well, first of all, they were separated from Jerusalem. Because one of the things one of the early kings had done is built a wall to keep his people from going to the Beis HaMikdash in Jerusalem, in the south. So the people in the north gradually over time became less connected to Yerushalayim and to Hashem, and idolatry was more prevalent in the northern kingdom. Most of the prophets, whose purpose was to come and warn the people not to worship idols, you go where the work is, and the work was in the north. It was a terrible, terrible state of affairs. And it was just a low period. And it mirrored the deterioration of the spiritual level of the Jewish people. You know, one of the greatest unifiers of the Jewish people had been Aliyah L'Regel, the mitzvah that every single Jewish person, man, woman, and child, would travel to Jerusalem for three times a year, Pesach, Shavuos, and Sukkot. Pesach, Shavuos, and Sukkot, Yerushalayim was filled, overflowing with every single Jewish person in all of Israel, came together. And of course, for the 200 years before Chizkiyahu, it didn't happen. Because of the split, because of the civil war, because of the wall. Chizkiyahu was a king of Yehuda, the southern kingdom. He was a king for 29 years. His father was a very wicked man, the prophet tells us. But Chizkiyahu was a good man. But you know, sometimes good is the enemy of great. So the narrative that I want to share with you is based on a narrative in the book Divrei HaYamim. Usually we call that the Book of Chronicles, one of the books of Tanakh. It's not so clear within the simple reading of the text, but it's based on the Talmud's interpretation and the commentary's interpretation of the Talmud to arrive at what I'm going to share with you. Chizkiyahu had a dream. He had a plan. He had a plan to repair the terrible breach of disunity that had existed for the previous 200 years. And his plan was, he was going to invite the entire Jewish people, the north as well as the south, to come to Yerushalayim to celebrate Pesach together. This is what had happened three times every year before the Civil War started. It had not happened for approximately 200 years. And this would have reunited the entire Jewish people for the first time in 200 years. And the fact is, to the best of our knowledge, it is the only overture during that 200 years to try to heal the split. Imagine. The Malbim, one of the commentators, later commentators to the narrative, the Malbim says that such an effort could have worked. And it would have created a level of Jewish unity and a level of spirituality that could have led to the Beis HaMikdash never being destroyed and to Chizkiyahu himself being the Mashiach, ushering in the Messianic era. Imagine, you have a plan to usher in the Messianic era. And the Malbim is saying it would have worked. The Gemara itself says Chizkiyahu could have been the Mashiach. No exile, no destruction, no Holocaust. Imagine the course of Jewish history. And here's the amazing thing. The king in the north, whose name was Hoshea ben Ela, who was not such a great person to begin with, he agreed. He was going to allow it. Again, for the first time in 200 years, he was going to allow everybody to go to Yerushalayim for Pesach. So it's a pretty good plan. It's a pretty amazing plan. Listen to what the pasuk says. V'yihu haratzim ovrim me'ir le'ir. So, a good plan needs good publicity. Chizkiyo sent messengers from town to town, city to city, because you got to prepare for this. It's not like he could just post it on Facebook. Messengers from town to town, city to city, to tell people, this amazing thing is going to happen soon, get ready. Everyone's going to come, it's going to work. And they went from the south to the north. All over Israel, these messengers went. V'hayu maschikim aleihem. But people laughed at them. Umaligim bom. And made fun of them. And scoffed at them. Someone from my previous community once said, peace is for babies. What do we care about peace? Let's stay enemies. Let's keep fighting. So what happened was, a few people did come, but most stayed home. And the Malbim says, when that happened, when this effort that was so grand in scope failed, at that moment was the final decree for the ultimate destruction of Yerushalayim and the Beis Hamikdash, and the decree for the exile was signed. And very soon after that, remember, we're 140 years before the destruction of the Temple of Yerushalayim, that's when Sanherib came and exiled the entire northern kingdom. The 10 tribes were exiled over 100 years before the destruction of the Beis Hamikdash. We refer to them as the 10 lost tribes. Sanherib came, conquered the northern kingdom, exiled the people. We still don't know where they are today. I think it's China, but that's my own personal opinion. We don't know. Lost to the Jewish people. Sanherib. So the northern kingdom was gone shortly. Jerusalem continued to decline spiritually, notwithstanding the warnings of the other prophets, Yeshayahu and Yirmiyahu, and 140 years later, the Holy Temple in Jerusalem was destroyed. The remaining Jews were exiled to Babylonia. And just think, it's so close to changing the course of Jewish history, human history. It could have happened. Imagine if the plan had been successful. Why didn't it work? So the Talmud says that the plan had one flaw. And that flaw was Chizkiyo had this great idea. But the Chachamim, the rabbis, the scholars said, don't do it. But he did it anyway. And it failed. It failed because the rabbis and the scholars told him not to do it. The pasuk says, "Vayivat hamelech v'sarav v'chol hakahol b'Yerushalayim lasos ha-pesach b'chodesh ha-sheni." The idea was, the advisors to the king told him, if you want this to come off, you could do it, but you're going to have to delay Pesach. Well, how do you delay Pesach? My wife has been asking me that question for 38 years.
Why would you have to delete this?
Because there wasn't enough time to get it organized. So the only way they could sending messengers here and there and arranging, can you imagine after 200 years to have hundreds of millions of people coming to Yerushalayim? You have to organize it. So the only way they could pull it off is to make a leap year. Do it in the next month. Meaning, make it into a Jewish leap year, like this year is a Jewish leap year. But the problem is, ki lo yochlu la'asoso be'eis hahi. But the problem was, the rabbi said to him, you're not allowed to make a leap year now. It's too late. Ki ha'kohanim lo hishadoshu l'madai. But if you don't make a leap year, it's not going to work because the Kohanim are not ready, the Beis HaMikdash is not ready, and the people are not going to come. So you have to make a leap year. The problem is you can't because of the following reason. The law is that you can only add a second month of Adar. The deadline is before the month of Nisan starts. Once the month of Nisan starts, then you don't have an opportunity to add another Adar. If you're in Adar, you can have a second Adar. Once you get to Nisan, you can't say, this is now Adar Sheni, the second Adar, and Nisan is in a month from now. But the problem was, it was already Nisan. It wasn't ready. The Kohanim were not ready. The infrastructure was not ready. There wasn't enough time to get people to come here. And so the only way it could have worked was for Chizkiyahu to proclaim in just the few days before Pesach, no, this month is now Adar, and we now have 5 or 6 weeks. Now, the idea sounds like a good idea, right? There is such a thing as a leap year, adding a month. There's a lot riding on it. It certainly sounds like a worthwhile reason. If you're going to proclaim a second Adar because the roads are muddy, because the crop hasn't started to come, that's very important, but a chance to heal the Jewish people, to bring about the Messianic era? But the problem is that Adar had already ended. And Nisan had begun. And the Chachamim, the rabbi, said to him, don't do it. But Chizkiyahu confused the means with the ends. Chizkiyahu thought to himself, I've got such a great goal. It's going to do so much to help the world and to heal the Jewish people. Okay, I'm doing something that's not exactly halakhically proper, but look at the results that I'm going to get. And Chizkiyahu decided, and his advisors decided, it's worth it. But he made a mistake.
Could have waited one more year, huh? Plan it for next year.
But the fact is, it fell apart. It fell apart. Martin Luther King said, you can't reach good ends through evil means because the means represent the seed and the ends represent the tree. And he did not listen to the rabbis, and the plan failed. And with it, his legacy failed. Because he was wrong. And the ends do not justify the means. So he prayed to God for forgiveness. And he said the following words, Hashem HaTov Yechaper ba'ad. God, who is good, forgive my rebellion. Those were the words he said. And this is such an important lesson for us. And it is so practical in our day, in our community. And that's why, according to Rabbi Huttner, we paraphrase Chizkiyo's prayer and we add it to our own prayer, Ulechaparas Pasha, specifically during those months that the leap year could legitimately have been proclaimed, but not when Chizkiyo wanted to do it. And therefore, in a leap year, from Cheshvan through the second Adar, which are the months when the deliberation is occurring, when the Sanhedrin HaGadol is meeting to decide this year, yes, no, we're not sure, let's discuss. While the months, while those deliberations would be going on if there was a Sanhedrin, when so many years ago a terrible mistake was made in how that decision was reached, we remind ourselves that we have to follow what God tells us. We have to remind ourselves of the terrible mistake that is made when we think that we know better than God.
Did he become sick right after that?
I don't know exactly the timeline.
No, but he was very sick.
He was, but I don't know exactly at what period it was. We are not allowed to substitute our own judgment for God's judgment. We have mitzvos, we have commandments, we have prohibitions. We are not allowed to decide which is more important, which is less important, which we can put away and ignore, and which we have to observe. We don't have the right to make those decisions. We don't have the right to decide which are the priorities and which can be sacrificed for other priorities. That's the mistake that Chizkiyo made. And so we add two words. Just like Chizkiyo prayed for himself. It's very subtle. It's two words that we say about nine times, approximately every 3 years. And there is certainly no overt reference to this whole story that I'm telling you. But if we are attuned and we use it as an opportunity to recall where those two words originally come from, we can recall an entire episode and we can review a critical lesson that it holds for us in our daily lives. And I think it's something that is very, very important to us. I think that a problem that we face is that all too often we engage in such considerations. And we think to ourselves, no, we know better. We know better than Hashem how to be able to get the results. People take it upon themselves to ignore certain things at the expense of others. It's a critical lesson. And this is a magnificent example of the subtlety of the lessons that the text of the prayers are trying to teach us. It's a magnificent thing. This coming week, Tuesday and Wednesday, Rosh Chodesh, we're going to say these two words, and then one more time, Adar Beis, we're going to say it, and then we're not going to say it again for several years. But just to think about this narrative and to think about the lesson that it holds for us. And if there's so much of a lesson just from those two words, can you imagine how many other lessons there are from every single word of the Siddur.